Okay, I'm calling to order this, what are we, February 9th, meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. Welcome, everyone. Today will be entirely informational hearings. We don't have any committee bills, do we, Matt? Okay. And this is going to be a continuation of our Workforce 101. And today we're going to be hearing from the good people who coordinate and plan and implement and do this work at the state level, at the regional level, and at the local level. So I'm going to open this informational hearing on the Workforce Investment Boards, but I know this is going to go beyond that topic. So I'm going to call up Ben Cannon, Lisa Neisenfeld, Aaron Kelly Seal, and Karen Hummelbaugh will all come up together.
I've got a cold, sorry. We're going to disinfect.
So you're going to tell us all about the workforce system, if there is a system.
Yeah, there's a system. Chair Dembro and the committee, thanks for having this hearing today. We're excited to try and explain our the way we're organized today. As you recall, last week we talked about the different...
And Lisa, before you go on, could you please identify yourself?
Sorry. Lisa Neisenfeld, Director of the Oregon Employment Department. Last week we looked at the system from point of view of the different populations that are served within the system by the different parts, and today will be a more organizational look. So the goals of the workforce system are throughout that system. The Oregonians have the skills for high wage and high demand jobs. The businesses have the workers they need in order to innovate and grow. And that the workforce system is aligned, integrated, efficient, and effective to support those two goals. So both job seekers and businesses. Implicit within the term employment, you must have both an employer and an employee, so we have to work both ends of that system. There's some operating principles that we've been operating with throughout the last few years. The first is moving decisions to the local level whenever possible. And that decision or that principle is really about that local economies are the what drive workforce needs and abilities to deliver on those needs. And that we cannot be at a state level prescribing specific industries or specific jobs. Those things are best left to our local partners. And our job is to support those local partners. Developing strategies led by employers, the system needs to be employer-led. That is the value that this slice of the workforce system offers, particularly with our partners in the education system, is that understanding and connection with what the economy is looking for and what it needs. And then finally, our goal is to optimize all resources available, taking all the friction out of the system wherever we can, trying to work as close partners with state and local organizations. So, I'm sure you've seen 1,000 diagrams of how the workforce system works, and we took another shot at it last Friday. I'd like to say this is a gross oversimplification, and we have not vetted this with our partners yet. So, but we're just trying to explain what the different state agencies do in relationship to those local systems. So you'll see OED and then CCWD/OED, I'll explain that in a minute, and HEC. We have a very interrelated connection. The parts of OED that are in this game are business and employment services. We are part owners of the WorkSource system, WorkSource being a joint venture between OED and the local workforce investment boards and their contractors. We also administer the unemployment insurance program, the Trade Act program, which retrains people who have lost their jobs due to trade imbalances, and our research department, which I think you're all familiar with. The CCWD-OED We have an interagency unit that we've developed over the last several months. Karen heads up that unit. She is a CCWD employee. We call it the PI, Policy, Innovation, and Evaluation. Their principal responsibility is to administer the Workforce Investment Act grants around the state. They also staff the Oregon Workforce Investment Boards. They do special projects, like right now we're working on an apprenticeship grant with Bowley. They're essentially our R&D department. It's populated by staff both from CCWD as well as OED, and so rather than having many, many interagency meetings now, they sit together and do the work, and I think it's been a very successful venture. Then we have the HEC, which Ben will talk about more later, but those are the main areas for which that agency is responsible, and then some of the pieces under CCWD that remain at the HEC, we don't anticipate further merger of those into our unit unless you all say so or something. Bowley plays a very important role in workforce development in their apprenticeship programs. We're spending a fair amount of time this year trying to ramp that partnership up. Apprenticeship is by far the most cost-effective and effective by itself strategy you've got for job training. It costs the public by far the least amount of money. We're looking to see how it can be extended beyond the construction trades. That system has a very well-developed and in-place system. We're not looking to mess with that at all, but we're looking to expand it to healthcare and manufacturing in particular in the coming year. DHS has that role of getting people with barriers ready to work. Their self-sufficiency and voc rehab programs are both very involved in the workforce system. And the Commission for the Blind also is a big player in helping us focus on the needs of that population. They all feed into these local systems, and so that's basically how we fit together. Does that questions at this point?
I just have one question. One entity that I don't see here that is, you know, a state agency that has a role to play in a way is Department of Corrections.
Right.
Right? And, you know, that how do they play in this?
You know, at this time, they don't directly. Several of us have seats on the Governor's Reentry Task Force, under WIOA, eventually those plans will expand to engulf them into the system, as it were. But right now, to be quite frank, we're not very integrated there. There are also connections. Transportation has workforce programs. We didn't include them in this, but there are a number of other agencies that have connections. Business Oregon, certainly, you'll see them in future slides here. They're connected they have a strong interest in the system. They don't get directly involved usually, but these are the players that are around the table in the workforce discussions right now.
Right. And then, of course, the Department of Ed is somewhat involved through career technical education as well.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And again, they don't tend to play directly, but as we develop in the coming year, you'll hear more about our interest in furthering a better focus on youth. That'll be more of an issue. As you may or may not know, I came to this job after leading an economic development organization, and I had dinner with one of my former colleagues the other night, and I asked, so is workforce still the number one issue when you're talking with companies, either companies who are growing or companies who are considering locating here? And she says, oh, yes. It's the number one issue, it's the number two issue, and it's the number three issue. It's, you know, there are certainly issues about developable land and tax rates and all sorts of infrastructure issues, but if you cannot get the workers, all of those things are for nothing. And businesses have become extremely concerned about their ability to do that. So that is one of the major messages we'd like you to hear today, that this is not just about us spending federal money. It's about attending to a serious crisis in growing the tax base and economic fabric of our state.
Vice Chair Thatcher.
I think a real quick question. What do you mean for companies engaged in economic development processes statewide? Do you mean in growing their businesses? What do you mean
both,
by that?
Both those. Typically, we divide economic development into two buckets. One would be existing businesses who are looking to grow. They may need to relocate or locate additional employees, but for some reason they have come to their local and state economic development organizations saying, I'm trying to do this, can you help me? And then the others would be businesses from outside the area looking to relocate here.
Okay, so just to clarify, so those that have contacted one or many or several of the entities that you showed on the chart at the beginning, so not necessarily.
No, Business Oregon or local economic development organizations.
Okay.
So in Portland, that would be the Portland Development Commission, or in Hillsboro, it's the City of Hillsboro, and they're all over the state with local organizations as well. Insight number two is really around what's happening, and we get asked this question about what's happening in the budget with workforce. And so we wanted to explain that because I think it's a big question mark that you're going to come up against later. CDAF is a fund that is given to the Oregon Employment Department. It's a 0.9% of 1% of unemployment insurance receipts through the state, and that money is provided to the Oregon Employment Department for administration. Over the years of the recession, when federal funds were coming in great big clumps, we were the Employment Department found itself with surpluses of a variety of those funds. At the end of this year, we calculate that we will have a fairly substantial ending balance, a very substantial ending balance of about $55 million because of those overages from time to time that have built up. Of that, about $20 million is needed for cash flow, payroll, things like that. The remainder, the governor's office has suggested that the governor's office put in the budget that funding would be, for the most part, put in the CCWD budget to go for training. Now I want to talk about a little bit, there's also a $6 million workforce piece that will go to Regional Solutions. This is a one-time deal in the sense that at the end of this year we'll be back to an ending balance of that amount needed for cash flow. But it's also a high priority around the state. Last April and May, we went around the state. We did about 18 regional forums with community partners and employers. The thing we heard over and over again was, this is not an economy where you can just take people and move them from one job into another. We really need more training resources. We need an opportunity to bump up those training resources, and Karen's going to talk about those in just a second. But it gives us a chance to do that R&D and tooling, which we rarely get to do in this system. So around the state, the number one priority was for more work-based learning, read apprenticeship, internships, mentorships, things like that, OJT. And the number two was for more classroom-based training available to employers and employees and people not in the workforce. So we think that's a very important investment at this point, and Karen's going to talk a little bit more about how that works.
Good afternoon, Chair Dimbrough, Vice Chair Thatcher. My name is Karen Hummelbaugh, and I am the Workforce Division Director at the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And as Lisa indicated, I also sit and live at the Oregon Employment Department, so kind of bridging that between the two agencies. And the funding that Lisa's talking about, and she mentioned, is really about getting more training for our customers. And we want to make sure that training that we're giving them is both industry-driven and also locally driven in each of the economies. One thing we've done over the last year is that we've actually changed a little bit the geography of our local workforce investment boards so that they're more representative of the regional areas of our state so that they can address those issues in a more local way. The funding that's in the CDAF transfer, it has three major components that we're looking at. The first is really a continued investment in the local workforce investment boards and their ability to provide training and for those folks to lead local strategies that increase the competitiveness for their industry and their communities. And it also has some funding that goes toward existing programs. We have a program called Back to Work Oregon, which is our on-the-job training program that was we've had now two biennia worth of data there that shows that on-the-job training will definitely increases the competitiveness and retention for employees. It also has funding for certified work-ready communities and the National Career Readiness Certificate, which is a certification that shows your work-based, your skills on the job. Then there's a significant component of the funding that is for an investment in youth and training for youth. And that would be funding both summer and school year programs for youth through the local workforce investment boards and also through the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. Those youth opportunities are going to provide job opportunities, obviously wages. They help with high school completion and career path for those individual youth. The third major component of the funding is for an investment in our incumbent workers, so the folks who already have jobs but perhaps need something to tool them up to move up forward or to not be laid off from their jobs. We did have a previous federally funded investment entitled the Employer Workforce Training Fund. Essentially was grants to businesses in local communities to allow them to do some incumbent worker training, and this would be sort of an extension of that. We don't have that funding anymore. We're also looking at what are the ways we can explore the opportunity for more shorter-term certificates and licensures for folks. How do we get folks certified in ways that are not through the traditional means necessarily and that are very industry-based, as Lisa talked about? And there's also a real focus in this investment on making sure that we're not leaving our rural Oregonians behind in their access to training and that it meets the geographic and community needs of all of the populations in Oregon. This means that we're looking at alternative ways of learning, such as distance learning, and being able to get out to those communities. And I think I'm starting in site number three for you. Are there any other questions about number two for Lisa and I? I'm not only the transition between Lisa and Ben, but I'm the transition between the two slides. So insight number three really has to do with how are we going to scale up the training that is industry focused and meet the system needs. We know this is a major challenge in how we are responding. And we are we talk a lot about industry sector strategies as the foundation of our system and how we are going to engage students, job seekers, and businesses. And really a sector partnership or a sector strategy is something where the conveners are engaging employers and stakeholders, and they're responding to the industry demands. And so they're compared to just the usual, we have some of these and we have some of these, we're actually engaging with the employers and talking about how do we solve the problem versus how does the program fit the need? Because it's so they're problem-oriented versus program-oriented. They're interdependent in that it's industry-based, not necessarily firm-based, it's independent. And that helps us with the bandwidth from the system perspective, but also from the employer perspective in creating a broader sense of what kind of skilled workers we're contributing. And we want to make sure that we're focusing particularly on the experiential and the work-based learning. Talked a little bit about this, but a lot of on-the-job training and a lot of apprenticeship opportunities, we know this is where we're going to get the most bang for our buck, essentially, in terms of how we're serving the employer needs and also keeping people out of the system again and keeping them on their own career path. So ultimately we want to make sure that people are moving forward and we're not seeing them back every time. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Ben, who's going to talk a little bit more about the link to education.
Thank you. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, I'm the executive director for Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and take the handoff from Karen and start by speaking generally just for a moment about the role of higher education and workforce development, and then specifically to this insight. I hope it's an obvious point. I'm sure it is to members of this committee that higher education is a major part of our system of preparing Oregonians for work. We do that through public and private colleges and universities. We do that through the training programs that they run and are connected to. We do that through the certifications and degrees that we provide. I want to specifically focus on the community college, which plays a particularly central role in workforce development. The efforts of our colleges, of course, include education and training that leads to degree and certificate, and this may be college-level work, or it may not be college-level work, or it may be both. So our colleges, in addition to sort of college-level courses that lead to certificate and degree, also helps to connect students with GED. They run adult basic skills programs that are also, should be also considered sort of fundamentally an important part of our workforce development system. Our community colleges, of course, also provide customized training in response to specific employer needs. Maybe certificates associated with those, or it may just be a program that an employer has come to a college and in conjunction with the college said, we really need this to support our workforce needs. And finally, colleges coordinate closely, many of them, with their local work source or other community entities to help students find jobs, access appropriate training, whether at the college or elsewhere, in order to support their individual opportunity and the employer needs in the region. I think looking at this insight about the need for more industry-focused training efforts, I think what I've come to understand is the importance of skills and the validation of skills in this new economy, and the job that the HEC has to do, supported by CCWD and in conjunction with the colleges, is to use industry and labor market data to help clarify skill needs and build in relevancy to skill certification so that what we're certifying fundamentally at the colleges reflects what the kinds of questions that employers are asking. In doing that, we help people, our students, figure out what skills they have and what skills they need in order to obtain a job. We're deploying tools that help people get and document skills in the most cost-effective way to help build their career pathway. So I think what some of the work that the HEC has done recently, some of it in conjunction with Echo Northwest and the Employment Department, to evaluate where there are particular job opportunities and the certificates or degrees that are associated with those can help feed back into the kind of state funding and program approval decisions that the HEC makes, our budget recommendations to you, and the work that the colleges do to really support training and education to meet employer and worker needs.
Chair Dembo, members of the committee, my name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I'm the director of the Department of Human Services. And I'm going to speak to you today a little bit about this fourth insight around the opportunity that we see for system alignment, particularly for those individuals who may need just a little bit of extra help, wouldn't on their own be accessing the workforce system, but certainly have a goal of achieving full integrated employment in the community, just like you or I or anyone else. I'm here today representing several programs. I'm representing programs serving very low-income people, some of whom have no work experience, others who have significant challenge in life that has created some barriers for them to be able to achieve employment. I'm here representing programs that are targeted at supporting people with disabilities to reach their full potential and their employment goals. That includes our programs that serve people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It includes our Voc Rehab program and services. And I'm also here graciously with permission from Daisha Johnson, who is the director for the Commission for the Blind, just because you only had four seats, and which is an extension of three. We've been really working hard the last few years as a system to create areas and to identify areas of opportunity to improve results that we get for Oregonians. That's the bottom line. That's why we all are here. And I would just point out a couple of places where we've been very focused and happy to answer questions. I know you have a lot more information to hear. First, in terms of customer service, this is a place where I think all of our organizations have been identifying opportunities to make sure that people have no wrong door, no wrong point of entry into any one of our systems, that they can then also leverage the full benefit of what each of our systems has to offer. We are doing that through things like co-location. We're doing that through things like establishing common business process for referral and warm handoff between agencies. And also through shared programs like Youth Transition, which is a partnership with the K-12 system and our disability programs, so that youth with disabilities have full exposure to opportunities so that they and their families know where they may be able to go upon exit from high school and what some opportunities for support might be so that they can achieve their goals and their dreams. We have some examples of that, I think, around our participation together to achieve some of the goals around National Career Readiness Certification, which has been demonstrated as a great way for people who have never entered the workforce to be able to demonstrate skills to employers, youth transition programs, which I already mentioned. And I also want to speak to the next body of work, which is equally important to us, which is around our opportunities with contracted services. Some of what we do in the Department of Human Services is direct service to our consumers. Some of that is service that we purchase from others around the opportunities those individuals have, either for skill development, basic skills, or support on the job. We've been having an active dialogue at the state and particularly at the local level around how we contract for those services so that we aren't duplicating and we're leveraging a full continuum and array of service for people who might need it. And I wanted to give you a couple of examples for that. Hot off the presses down in Jackson and Josephine County, we have a single request for proposal that's going out that includes programs that are both Department of Human Services programs, Employment Department Services program, and Workforce Investment Act programs so that we can establish through one contractor a single continuum of workforce supports and services that can meet the needs of all of our many consumers in that region. We also in the metro area have a new grant opportunity that we've been able to leverage. It was only made available to departments that administer the Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program, but it leverages partnerships with employment, with the workforce system, and also many of our local nonprofits, Outside In, ERCO, Construction Hope. We have the Oregon Tradeswomen. There's a huge network of nonprofits that are targeting very specific populations for career advancement, but they qualify for this opportunity by virtue of their eligibility for our Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program. So just a couple of examples around how we contract and what we provide for people in the way of service that we're working on to be more coordinated. And lastly, I want to talk about shared accountability for results. This has been a big emphasis at the state level, really talking about what are the results that we're trying to get for people and creating accountability across programs for the same kinds of things. This has been a heavy lift, just getting us across federal programs, across program requirements, to have a common language from a consumer perspective about what it is we're trying to achieve, and then realigning both at the state and the local levels around how we're measuring and how we can be accountable to you and to taxpayers about how we do that. So those are just a few examples of system alignment that are very important to us right now. We have a lot of work to do yet, but there are many things underway.
Thanks, Erin. Were you going to say anything about the Commission for the Blind specifically?
Just that I appreciate that the Commission's participating at this table. They have such an important role in terms of skills training for people who experience blindness and also training for employers who are hiring people who experience blindness. And so they've been a valuable partner, both in terms of our efforts and conversation around accessibility and employer engagement around special populations, but also just because by virtue of the population that they serve.
Questions, colleagues, for anyone on this panel?
Mr. Chair, I have a lot, but I'm not sure if you want to take up all the time at committee.
Well, you can throw out a couple of them.
Well, okay. How about It sounds like, okay, we work from the employers and then go to the individuals, and I guess somewhere along the line you're trying to match them up. So how do you define success on the employer end, and how do you find success, define success on the employee end? So whoever wants to start.
Chair Dembro and Senator Thatcher committee, we actually deal on both ends of that continuum, both employer and employee, and success is defined in terms of federal performance measures that are placement, wage placement, and retention. Those are the major federal. There's also customer satisfaction. But right now in place, the only employer measure we have is customer satisfaction. We're working diligently on looking at how we measure better results from our activities with employers. That's hard not to get unintended consequences. So for example, if we measured market penetration, for example, how many employers do we have relationships with, that could simply cause us to have relationships with every fast food outlet in the state. That would be great market penetration, but not where we're going. We're trying to do that through sector strategies, working with key groups that are appointed by our local partners that the state will be partners with as well. Each of them will set up outcome measures for that, for those strategies. So it's kind of a mixture of things.
Sure. Senator Thatcher, Chair Dembro, within higher education, as a the state objective, of course, emphasizes the completion of certificates, degrees, workforce training programs. As we've, the HAC has looked more closely at outcome measures and what matters for individuals, we've also begun to take a look at measures of earnings after graduation or after completion, measures of employment after graduation or after completion, in order to understand not merely whether a student earned a completion, but whether that paid off and how that paid off. So as we present, for example, our recommendations to the Ways and Means Committee around key performance measures, we will be including those measures of employment and earnings, data that we derive through cooperation with the employment department. So I think that helps address the question. There are other and even more, I would suggest, even more profound ways in which a sort of employer perspective is being taken into account by colleges and universities as they develop programs, as they develop curricula, and some really interesting and important employer data or feedback that they are cultivating in some very narrow program-specific ways, some more general ways that we'd be happy to share with you.
Just maybe a quick comment. I was hoping maybe I would hear also from you that you would take into consideration whether their employment after completion of their degree or certification actually is at all related mm-hmm. to what they studied. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Senator Thatcher, Chair Dembro, yes, it's certainly our intent to do that. It can become difficult as a practical matter because of the type of data that we keep about how they're employed at the Department of Employment, as well as the type of data we keep at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission about how they were trained or educated. It doesn't necessarily provide the level of specificity that we'd like in order to answer that question, but it's certainly a one worth asking and one we're trying to get our hands around.
And we can provide general data about that. But for example, if you're looking at IT professionals, mm-hmm. they're employed in every industry, not just a single industry.
Right.
It's difficult to get your arms around that.
Right. That's why I said it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, some of our most skilled IT people actually majored in philosophy, right? And, you know, got a fair amount of on-the-job training and were able to use their, whatever, ability to do the thinking that they do to transfer that to coding. It's, you know, it's hard really to say that this major leads to that occupation. Other questions? I have one for you, Ben, and maybe Karen. So, you know, you mentioned the creation of certificates and degrees, and I know that it is a challenge to, as you're coming up with shorter term certificates that are designed to meet industry needs. How do you balance the idea of being able to produce more certificates with making sure that they're really high value certificates? That is, they really do lead to an improvement in the person's job status. And I guess tied to that is the question of how do you get industry to buy into the certificate, whether we're talking about the generic national careers career readiness certificate or a specific new short-term skills certificate.
Mr. Chair, I can give a very bureaucratic and process-oriented answer, and then Karen can add sort of a more thoughtful perspective on it. I know as a commission, we're responsible for approving or not proposals for new certificate programs at community colleges, for example. And that process requires the community college to have demonstrated employer demand for the certificate, the expected sort of earnings outcomes for students to try to get at that question, okay, this there may be some demand, but is this a good investment for a student? And we evaluate that type of data in the consideration that the commission pays to whether or not to approve a new program. So I think that's on the sort of technical side, that is how we, part of how we decide whether or not to permit institutions to develop new certificates. And quite frankly, what the institutions do as a result of that process is work very hard with their local community to ascertain need. These programs are typically created as a result of not even necessarily some bright idea by a faculty member, as bright as they are, but by an employer who has come to the college and said, this is where we're short. Can you help? And that's when the faculty and the administrators get involved and say, well, yeah, we can put these courses together, create a new program, and that's the kind of thing that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I think the way that practically happens when we referenced a little bit about the sector strategies is that those sector strategies and those industries coming together, it's really driven from the local level, from the industries in your community, and coming and saying these are our needs, and then working with the partners, which include the colleges and others, to talk about what are the best solutions for that. So is it an industry certification that comes from the industry? Is it from the community college? Is it something like the National Career Readiness Certificate, which is actually, ACT normed it and it's nationwide, and so that works at a basic level. It's the industry is helping to create that is how that we're making that happen when you ask about the buy-in question, and that it's locally driven, so it's more specific to communities than saying this works for every company in Oregon, or this is a certification that should be at every college, or this is something we want. And there was there's a recent example that started out of the Portland area, but it's statewide now, which is the Code Oregon project, which is really industry driven in terms of training computer programmers, and I'm not going to quite get this exactly right because it's not my area of expertise in the titles for their jobs, but that folks can go online and get this opportunity to learn how to program, and there are a couple of job occupations that are within that, and you could do that from anywhere in this state, and it's also an occupation that you can then do from anywhere in that state, and there's a conversation with the colleges about how you could potentially give credit or certify for that beyond just the industry standard certification, and so that's sort of how those conversations are happening. That's just one example practice of how that would work.
Okay, thank you, panel. Appreciate your being here, kicking off this broad view. Our next panel is from the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. We have Frank Wall, Barbara Bird, and Melissa Leone. Welcome, Melissa.
Welcome. Thank you, Chair Dembro. For the record, I'm Melissa Leone. I'm the board manager for the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. Today, we have a couple of board members, Frank Wall from the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association and Barbara Bird with the Oregon AFL-CIO, who are here to talk with you about the roles and the functions of the State Board, as we've talked about under the, you know, the principles and the system goals that you just heard about. In case the committee does not know, the committee involves the youth. The committee chair is a member of the State Board. We have four legislative members, two from the Senate and two from the House. And Senator Rosenbaum did, until just recently, also serve on the board. So it's a pleasure to be here today. And I think we're going to start, I think we'll let Frank start and talk a little bit about the roles, and then they're also going to contribute from sort of their perspective about being on the board.
Thank you, Melissa. Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, thank you. I represent 150 members in the state of Oregon.
Frank, can you please give your name for the record?
It's Frank Wall.
Sorry.
I'm the Executive Director of the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. As I said, I represent 150 members throughout the state of Oregon who employ about 3,000 journey workers and 400 apprentices. I am currently the chair of the Local 290 Joint Apprenticeship Council. I am a local member of the Workforce Board of Clackamas County. Senator Dembro and I served together on the CTE Advisory Committee for Portland Public Schools. And I'm currently a member of the Oregon Building Congress, which is trying to create opportunities for youth in the construction industry. So I have a passion in this. The OWIB is appointed, OWIB members are appointed by the governor. And we basically provide policy oversight to the system. The board is led by private industry. We have organized labor. Barbara's a good friend of mine. We have education, who you've seen, community-based organizations, economic development, elected officials, and other government agencies. The OWIB advises the governor about what the workforce system should achieve. And the agencies who you heard from determine how we achieve those outcomes. In fact, we have a great relationship with the governor. We just met him in our last meeting, and we had a great conversation, and we both made a recommitment to our goals. So we get a lot of support from the governor's office. I see the important thing is that the workforce system must partner with local industries to better identify all the skill shortages we had, and you've heard some of those before. But a case in point, in Clackamas County, we have a lot of senior care facilities, but we have a shortage of people who will work in them. We have a shortage of RNs who will come in and work in them. So we have a sector strategy to try to develop that. So all the local boards have identified certain sectors in their area that they need to concentrate on. And the industry also needs to determine what programs we're having. Is this something we don't have and we need to create it? Is it something that maybe we need to put an investment in and grow? Or is it something, if we ask the question, it really has no purpose anymore and we need to eliminate it? And if I speak for business representatives, our important thing is to help gather the information as to what our needs are now, as well as what our needs are going to be in the future. It's really, really important in my industry, in the construction industry, the generational changes that are coming. We have a very, very aged workforce, and it takes, in the apprenticeship program, maybe 5 years to train people. Our problem is that we can't identify the right people to train. So we need to have this partnership with the education, because, you know, I had the advantage of CTE in middle school and in high school. And so you could identify the mechanical intelligence of the individual who naturally track into that trade if they wanted to. Now, when I interviewed 700 apprentices last year, when you ask them what they do as a hobby, it's not that they're working on their cars or they're doing something mechanical. It's that they're gaming. Seriously. That doesn't mean they don't have mechanical intelligence. It's just harder for us to identify. So if we can have pre-apprenticeship programs, if we can have CTE in middle school, and the workforce board can identify those things, I think we can track the pipeline in a little bit more successfully. So I guess you might say, what value does this, you know, my membership of OWIB have, and for business? You guys hear a lot of voices a lot of times. But a lot of times the voices don't have any conversation with each other. They just have their particular note that they want to sing, and that's it. The OWIB, if you can see the membership we have, has a lot of voices, but what we really have is a conversation. And that those conversations are extremely vital. And the fact that business gets to sit at the table and have those conversations helps us provide solutions. So I guess at the end of the day, we all want one thing, and that's to create jobs for all Oregonians. And we want to help all Oregonians grow and achieve. And I think OWIB is the convener of that, and I think they're the agent that coalesces the groups to be successful.
Chair Dembro and Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, it's great to be here. Thank you. And I don't have a lot to add. Actually, Frank did a great job. He usually
Should
does.
I kick you into the table now?
Yeah. But I do want to say a little bit about the
Tina Carver, could you say your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. You have to remind all of us about that. Barbara Byrd, I'm Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. And I should say, I have sat on the OWIP for going on 4 years now. Prior to that, I worked with the labor representatives on OWIP and the local workforce boards from around the state for about 4 years, helping train them and get them ready for that service. So I've been involved with the system for a while now. And for us in organized labor, I think the role that OWIP plays and increasingly plays under this restructuring of providing oversight to the state workforce system is really important. The OWIP has a goal of ensuring that workforce resources are used in a targeted way to train for high wage, high demand jobs, and in sectors where, as Frank was talking about, where the opportunities are the greatest. So trying to be strategic about the use of public resources. How that's done is by investing in a number of programs that we talk about a lot in OWIB meetings: career and technical education, registered apprenticeship, work-based and experiential learning, career readiness, industry-recognized credentials. So thinking about those programs, serving on subcommittees sometimes to help develop those programs, and then holding the system accountable for results in those program areas, for results in continuous improvement, I would say. From organized labor's perspective, the system is really important. We feel like because of our federally mandated participation on these boards, we're able to bring a worker's voice into the conversation. The boards all have, by statute, a majority of business representation, but workers want to be heard, too, about what they're up against when they are trying to hang on to jobs and need more skills, when they've been laid off from work and need to be retrained for new jobs, when they're coming out of high school and are looking for ways to get into the workforce in the first place. So we try to be cognizant of those needs and to speak for those needs from our positions on the state and local boards. We help develop a plan, the current strategic plan's in effect right now, with our business partners, with others on the board, that really reflects our goals, I think, in a number of ways. And just to summarize what those goals are, they are to train not just for any job, but for family wage jobs. They are to train in ways that help raise the state's median wage. They are to help promote the registered apprenticeship system, which we feel, and Frank's already spoken to, is one of the best ways to train skilled workers in blue-collar fields and increasingly in healthcare and manufacturing as well. And finally, I think the goal that's voiced in the strategic plan and that we take to heart is the goal of equity, to bring opportunities to people who are often denied a place in our state workforce system, whether that's because of disabilities or race or ethnicity or age or gender. We take those very seriously as well. And I think on OWIB, these are the kinds of things that we talk about and keep in mind when we do our work. And from organized labor's perspective, it's a very important part of what happens in the state.
And I was just going to talk, this is Melissa Leone again with the board, about one last role and function of the board. You saw from the state agencies that what we're talking about is the relationships between the workforce system and education human services and economic development. So the other role that the state board can play is in that board level connection between those same areas of policy in the state to both increase the alignment of policies, talk about joint strategic investments in those systems to achieve our common outcomes, and to make sure that we're having sort of integrated or common strategies and not things working against each other. I just wanted to, you heard, I think, both from Ben Cannon and Karen a little bit earlier about some of those sort of common outcomes. The OEB and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission actually formed a task force this year that looked at ways that those two systems could work, higher education and the workforce system could work better together from that board level. And we'll be moving forward with this, with sharing common outcomes, but also in ways that the two boards can have a collaborative policy conversation and talk in the next budget cycle. We were a little too late for this one, but in the next budget cycle about some joint strategic investments or leveraging of resources in a more explicit fashion. So that was a start, I think, on some more conversations that the board expects to engage in with economic development and with some of the other boards and commissions that have workforce system programs in them.
Great. Thank you, Melissa. Questions? Okay. I do have a couple. This one for you, Melissa. So Frank mentioned that the OWIB is sort of rechartering itself right now, and that is as a result of changes to the Workforce Investment Act, right? The Workforce Investment Act is now, what is it, the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act, is that right?
Or? Chair Denver, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. There's still an I.
Okay.
It's a different I.
All right. Great. So can you say something about, the extent to which WIOA drives this process and how, we're going to try to be responsive to those changes?
Chair Dembrough. So the state of Oregon was already, and I think with the board, was already in a process of sort of changing its role. All of you in the 2014 session passed Senate Bill 1566, which added some additional responsibilities, the holding the system accountable, entering into performance compacts with local boards, to the state board's roles last year. So that track was already ongoing. And then in the summer, Congress passed the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, which for state boards across the country added a new set of roles and responsibilities that very consistent with the way the state of Oregon was going, but changes add some decisions and some roles in terms of advising the governor on continuous improvement of the workforce system and sharing best practices and other ways that it can support these kind of integrative, innovative functions in workforce systems.
Thank you. Frank, Barbara, you both mentioned the importance of the apprenticeship model, and I think a lot of people are interested in taking that model and expanding it to other industries, as you mentioned, apprenticeship is a system that has proven itself in the construction trades. It has a long history there, where you're really talking about strong, legitimate partnerships between contractors and labor. How do you spread that mindset to employers in, say, manufacturing or others? Because really, it's not going to work if it's not a shared kind of thing. The state can't do it. The state maybe in some ways can create incentives, but a lot of it has to be just a feeling of mutual need, mutual investment. So I wonder if you could, sorry to put you on the spot with that, but both of you respond to that.
I'll take a stab at it. I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm sitting on the planning committee for the Department of Labor's new this apprenticeship grant that we're trying to figure out how to apply for. And manufacturing and healthcare, of course, are targeted sectors for that grant, not construction, where there's already well-established programs. And it's interesting to reflect back kind of on the history of apprenticeship in Oregon. 20 years ago, there were quite a few registered apprenticeship programs in manufacturing. All the steel mills had them. Boeing actually still has one. Freightliner had one. It was a pretty well-established model, but I think as time went by, a lot of those programs were dropped. It requires a financial contribution from employers. It requires a commitment to retaining the workforce, and so in industries where there's cyclical employment and so on, it's been difficult to maintain. But I think there's interest in manufacturing. I think part of the problem is that for these kinds of registered apprenticeship programs to work, you have to bring groups of employers together, and they have to agree to train together and not steal each other's employees and so on. I mean, it's a kind of a group arrangement that takes some getting used to, I think, for companies that aren't used to working together as closely. But I think there's interest. And when I talk to the employers on OWIB, that sit on OWIB, there's a lot of interest among those employers in helping work with their colleagues in the business community to figure out how to make this work. It's certainly a model that can work. It has worked in the past. So hoping we can find some inroads into that by using this federal money that we're going to get for sure.
Thanks, Barbara.
I simply have employers come to me and say, I don't have enough trained employees. They say, what do you do to invest in your own industry? It's as simple as that. Once you start putting together whether Oregon manufacturers competing with the state of Washington, California, or globally, they need to invest in apprenticeships. And, the initial thing is everybody comes from a personal, well, I don't want to spend money on this particular person. I'm going to train them, and then they're going to go somewhere else. Well, the point is that in a good apprenticeship program, you have rotation because you want people to agree and train and see other places to work. And at the end of that, you become a competitive market. And, if this person really shines and they're really good, they can go to work for that company. So I think when they see that the model, at least in the construction industry, is very competitive, but actually the construction industry is sustaining their generational losses because we can grow the people through the apprenticeship program. If you don't have that program, they're going to go out of business. I used to be 31 years in the printing business. We stopped our apprenticeship program. We don't have many printing companies anymore in the state of Oregon as we did in the 70s. We just didn't, we lost the market.
One of the criticisms that you hear about apprenticeship is that it's kind of a closed thing, that is, people who get into apprenticeship are relatives of others who've gotten in, and that the system has perpetuated something that really favors traditional workers, white male workers. I think as has been referred to, the OWIB, and I think a lot of people are thinking about how to break that model. And so do you all have anything to suggest in that respect, Frank?
Well, my experience as a chair in my working with BOLI is that we do that. We have rules and policies and procedures that eliminates that nepotism now. And we have standards that we have to reach, in classifications. So it's tough because some people come trained because it's been at their grandfather's table, their table. They do that type of work. They watch their parents do that type of work, or the family does it. But I can say in my last 6 or 7 years, there's been a real movement away from that.
Yeah, and it was mentioned in the previous, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. It was mentioned by the previous panel that there are some very good pre-apprenticeship programs operating, especially in the metro area, Oregon Tradeswomen, Constructing Hope, Portland Youth Builders, that have provided kind of a bridge between those underserved communities and the registered apprenticeship world. And I think they've been actually very effective, at least in the metro area, and hopefully that can spread across the state and we can use that model and learn from it.
Some people are saying that if the state has a role to play in supporting programs, it's at that level, that is, the pre-apprenticeship level, whether you're talking about those kinds of programs or, CTE in the high school or community college, those kinds of things, to provide workers who are ready to be apprentices and then industry playing the primary role than in doing the actual apprenticeship. Is that something that makes sense to the two of you?
Senator Dembro and Vice Chair Thatcher and the committee, yes, I do think that's an important role. But it's getting qualified people to be applicants. And, again, that's what you used to get through the schools and the counselors. There aren't many counselors in high school now that say there's an opportunity at the electrical, you know, apprenticeship program or the bricklayers or what. That information is not there. We are now trying to work a program with Clackamas Community College. I've had a conversation with President Truesdell. And what we do is when we find applicants, so let's say we have 700 people apply for the next apprenticeship program, and maybe 450 are qualified. That means they have the math or the right education and all the other things you need to do. What we've been doing in the past is just saying, well, you don't qualify. What we're now going to do is put them a menu together saying, this is where you need to go. Where do you live? This is the resource you need to go if you want to come into this program. These are the areas. These are the Oregon Tradeswomen pre-apprenticeship programs you can go to become more qualified. We're not talking to each other back and forth. And I think that really affects also the nepotism we were talking about.
Okay, panel, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. See you at the next meeting. All right, our final panel. Now, we're moving steadily from the clouds down to earth, and we're now at the local level. And we have people from the local WIBS and I think an employer. Great.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, many members of the committee. My name is Christina Payne. I'm the Executive Director with Lane Workforce Partnership. We're the local workforce investment board in Lane County. And I have Tony Frazier on my left and Jennifer Adams on my right. And they will further introduce themselves. But before we do, we have a video that explains the role of the local workforce boards. And it's
Oregon's app.
It's 40 minutes long?
It's 45 minutes. No, it's 3 minutes.
Average all-industry wage is close to where it was in 1976. Oregon has the second lowest graduation rate in the country. Rural Oregon is not yet rebounding from recession job losses. Who is working to address these kinds of challenges? Local workforce boards. Every county in Oregon is represented by a local workforce board. These business-led partnerships are primarily funded through the Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act and chartered by the governor to better direct public workforce investments for talent development, job creation, and business competitiveness. The boards set the convening table and bring together private business with partners from local government, education, organized labor, economic development, and community-based organizations. The primary goal is to build a workforce system that is flexible, customer-focused, and responsive to local needs. They elevate the voice of business to articulate workforce needs and inform investments and strategies to meet those needs and to ensure alignment and the efficient use of resources to achieve better outcomes. Supply skills development so workers can fill current and emerging high-wage, high-demand jobs. Support youth so they have the academic and core competencies required by employers. Respond to the needs of employers so they have the skilled workers they need. Using labor market data and analysis, local workforce boards broker services in their communities to meet these goals. Services and investments are organized around sector partnerships, which target regional industries essential to local economies. Local boards invest in WorkSource Oregon as the primary vehicle for delivering workforce services across the state. In partnership with the Oregon Employment Department and other agencies, WorkSource Oregon helps customers learn new skills, find employment, and progress in careers, while also assisting employers with recruitment and retention of qualified, skilled employees. The majority of youth served are low income with complex barriers to employment. Youth services connect participants to career opportunities, training, and one-on-one support in order to prepare them for post-secondary education and career ladder employment. Youth gain the essential skills needed to be successful and self-sufficient. Oregon's local workforce boards are essential to economic prosperity and thriving communities. They are committed to continuous improvement and are accountable for providing high-performing systems that yield a maximum return on investment. Investing in human potential. Responding to the needs of business. Creating opportunities for growth. Find out more at OregonWFPartnership.org.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. Again, my name is Christina Payne, and that was a basic overview of the work that we do. In Lane County for Lane Workforce Partnership, our mission statement is to meet the workforce needs of employers and individuals through partnerships and innovation. And so we have two sides that we balance in order to achieve economic prosperity. We need to meet the needs of employers while also working with individuals to make sure that they have access to the training, understand what training is required of them, understand their current skill sets, and understand how they're going to reach those higher levels of skills so that they can meet the needs. I've worked in workforce development for 14 years. And so when we talk about sector strategies, I can tell you when they come together and work really well, they can do some really incredible things on the ground. One of the examples that my colleagues hear me talk about a lot is our work that we did in Lane County with the healthcare sector. We brought together local employers and actually before we even brought them together, we started with the data. The data that many of you have probably heard Graham Slater come and talk to you about, the data that our state has is incredible. We have it gives us a great platform and a starting place to have really intelligent conversations with employers. So we had the data, we had an idea of where the gaps were going to be, but it doesn't tell the whole story. So in meeting with the healthcare industry in our region, and it is different from region to region. The needs, you know, when I hear Portland talking about what their needs are, it's different in our region. And in talking with the employers, we identified what those gaps were. We identified what individuals would need to have to meet those needs. We were able to invest targeted funds into expanding nursing programs. There were some things that we wouldn't have even known by the data. Things like there was a great need for medical technologists. The need came to us. You would have thought that we needed thousands of them when, in fact, by the end of the year, they needed two. But it was critical. It was one of those things that you don't know until you talk to someone about how critical it is to have an individual who can diagnose lab results that indicates if someone has cancer. So those are the kinds of things that we learn about and identify where the training programs exist for these individuals, because it doesn't always make sense to create an entire program for two people. But we found it through the Medical College of Georgia, and it's a distance program that Peace Health uses to this day in order to get someone from that medical technician to the medical technologist position. In addition, as we established these relationships on the ground, we were able to partner up with the Department of Human Services and identify individuals who had healthcare in their background, or maybe working as a CNA, a nurse's assistant, but they were on TANF. They weren't able to support themselves. We were able to identify a group of individuals, work with them over a course of a couple years, and we had built the trust by the employers that they would review these individuals as they came out, interview them, and bring them into their organizations. And looking, these several of those individuals are working, and are probably at a higher level now, making $38 an hour as registered nurses. And that's the kind of difference it can make. all along the spectrum, from the high end to the low, and in meeting an individual's needs and in meeting an employer's needs at the same time.
Do we want? Well, she's talking about on-the-job training. Do you want to talk about workforce? Yeah, that's her next slide. Did you want to talk about it, too?
I can.
Okay.
Welcome, Tony.
Thank you. Chair Dembro and Vice Chair Thatcher and members of the committee, my name is Tony Frazier with Insight Incorporated, representing the Workforce Board for Lynn, Marion, Polk, and Yamhill Counties. I think I'll take a little bit of a youth and young adult angle here in terms of how the Workforce Board connects locally. I actually serve on the steering committee for CTEC, which is our local career tech high school that's being put up on Portland Road here in Salem. And I'm part of a subcommittee on that group also that is looking at what the next two programs will be coming up in the fall of 2016. The first two programs they're looking at is manufacturing and construction in the fall of 2015. I say that to make the point that we can really be everywhere as much as is humanly possible, but we need to be plugged in from a Workforce Board perspective to all the things that go on in a community that help us to advance, especially in respect to educating the emerging workforce. There's a report that came from that was commissioned by the White House called The Economic Value of Opportunity Youth. And in that, it defines opportunity youth as ages 16 to 24, not working and not in school. There's 6.7 million of those young people in the United States, roughly 60,000 in the state of Oregon. When we talk to employers and we talk about employer shortages, especially as far as the worker pipeline goes, I think we see some real opportunity in engaging this opportunity youth demographic. But we have two real big challenges here. One is re-engaging them. So this emerging workforce, the thing that we find interesting is that they're not so emerging. We have to figure out how to get them to re-engage so that we can then skills train them. We do that in a variety of ways. One of the ways that we've put together locally is something that we call the Career Achievement Network. We've branded it the NET. And in the NET, what we did was we reached out to our local employer consortia and we listened, and they said, give us someone who can get along in the workplace. I find it interesting, we haven't thrown soft skills on the table yet, but it's definitely out there. Give us someone who can get along in the workplace, and we'll be willing to skills train them. So we know that that's a great need. One of the interesting things, though, from a federal dollar perspective is that there is no outcome attachment or no qualifier for gaining the skill set of soft skills. But we set about trying to figure out how do we get at that regardless. We have to figure out how to solve this. And so in the NET, it's made up of three basic pillars, I call them. One is a soft skills training component. We call it career-based training. It's based around cognitive behavioral techniques, which gets at the notion that you don't need years of therapy to approach job search better. You just need to change some of the ways that you think about that. We ran a pilot here a while back and found it to be very effective and have since put together a youth curriculum. We're talking about youth, thousands of them in our state, in our local communities, that have never held W-2 jobs. So that pillar gets at the soft skills piece. We couple that with a 200-hour work experience that can play out either at a nonprofit or a for-profit, and then every 50 hours through that 200-hour work experience, they're evaluated against a set of soft skills criteria. The goal of the Career Achievement Network is to create more first-time work experience space. The one thing that I think everyone agrees on is that for young people to have work experience, they need a space for that to play out. And so with these three pieces, putting them all together, in practicality, we have a program in Independence. It's a construction skills training program. There were six partners involved originally. We now have a seventh in that United Way is also funding. So the other thing workforce boards are able to do is take the existing resources we have, the federal resources, the state resources, and then reach out and leverage those resources in partnership. This partnership included the City of Independence, the SEDCOR Construction Alliance, Habitat for Humanity, Insight Incorporated, and two of Insight's youth-funded programs. What we did was we rebuilt repaired sidewalks, city sidewalks, for low-income families in the city of Independence. It was a win-win-win for everyone. Out of that, there was a young man named Jacob who he wanted to become a union carpenter apprentice. Now, we've talked a lot about CTE and apprenticeships and so forth, so this is like the perfect fit. I was so excited to come up here. Jacob wanted to become a union carpenter apprentice, and so he started in our program, and at graduation, he had himself on the list. And part of the reason for that was we took that group out to the training center in Adair, the Labor's Training Center, and he learned how to get himself on that list. Upon graduation, he had himself on the list. When you're on that list, you can't go to work for a non-union contractor, so he's waiting for his name to move up, but he immediately went to work for Setnicker Farm. When I got the message from his director that said, hey, Jacob got a job with a union contractor, I was so excited. I call him up on his cell phone, and he's so thrilled, and he's telling me about his work. And I said, well, tell me something. How much were you making at Setnicker Farm? He said, $9 an hour, which wasn't too bad for a kid who was making zero when he found our program. He was actually homeless couch surfing. I said, well, what did you start at as a union carpenter apprentice? He said, $16.97 an hour, and that doesn't include $6.67 in fringe benefits and accruing PTO that I get to keep when I have 240 hours in. I said, you went from $9 to $17 an hour? He said, yeah, I'm so excited. I talked to him just a few months ago. I actually met him for breakfast. I like to keep in touch. And he had gone to work for another contractor, and he was working on a job at Oregon State University. And I asked him, I said, did you get a bump in pay when you went to work for this other contractor? Now, mind you, he's just a little over a year with the union. He looked at me in the eye, and he said, I make $23.50 an hour now. I said, $23.50 an hour? Do you know how long it took me to make $23.50 an hour in my career? And he kind of grins. Here's the most important or most powerful thing he said next. He said, I'm thinking about going to college now. He couldn't have had that thought 18 months prior to that because he was trying to figure out where he was going to sleep, right? So the WIOA legislation is focused more on opportunity youth, and that oftentimes is where we spend our time in engaging that demographic and that population and trying to create programming through federal and state investment and through leveraging that programming with other nonprofits and other organizations within our community to do just that, to create those kinds of opportunities for these young people to advance.
Okay. Thanks, Tim.
Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name's Jennifer Adams, and I'm with Bulk Handling Systems. I'm the HR director there, and we are a manufacturer of recycling systems based out of Eugene, Oregon. 3 years ago when I started with the business, I came into a unique situation. They actually experienced the majority of their growth in 2008 when everyone else was basically shrinking. So they had the advantage, unfortunately, when other businesses were going out of business to increase their workforce from about 35 employees to about 150. By the time I got there, they were growing again. We're now at 350-plus employees across the U.S., but we had a gap. We could not find employees for our manufacturing shop. Now, we primarily employ fabricator welders. And what we found through temp agencies, going to career fairs, talking to the employment agency, was that there were people out there looking to get into our field, wanting to learn the skill set, but didn't have that opportunity to learn it, whether it be through CTE programs, they couldn't get into a community college, and we were at a loss on how we could get them into the workplace for us. I had the luck of attending a local Human Resources Association meeting where Robin Scott was there, who was with the Lane Workforce Partnership at the time, talking about on-the-job training. She came in, spoke to our company about it, and we decided to sign up. We thought, well, it couldn't hurt. We couldn't find the candidates that we needed so we could get the product out the door. In 2014, we were very successful. We actually were able to bring in 8 individuals that prior to this program being brought into our company, we probably wouldn't have looked at. They may have been box boys. They may have touched upon, they may have picked up a welder once in their high school career, but they had that desire to be on that shop floor. So we were able to bring them in. The company brought in about $27,000 in funding through the on-the-job training, which we get for bringing in and training these individuals. But what we find more exciting is that within a six-month time period, these eight people made over $150,000 in wages. We have many, many openings available. And without this, finding this candidate pool, I don't think we would be successful in finding people for this job. And if we don't have the people on that shop floor in our offices, we can't get the product out the door and we're not going to be a successful business. Actually, just today, as right before we came up here, I was in a meeting with our operations management staff and our company president having the exact same conversation again. We need 24 people for our manufacturing floor, and where are we going to find them? I've found Lean Workforce Partnership and the Employment Services Department to be a fantastic resource for us. Not only do they keep an eye on what we're up to and give me a call before I even get a chance to pick up the phone, but they're letting us know about programs ahead of time. One of our really successful stories was I was attending a seminar, and the individual that's in charge of the youth side of Lean Workforce Partnership approached me and said, "Did you know about Springfield High School and their CTE program?" We didn't know it existed, unfortunately. We got to tour that program. It was a phenomenal program. It still is a phenomenal program. Not only are they teaching the vocational skills that those students need to be successful on our shop, they're also teaching them the business skills or the soft skills to be successful in the workforce. And through those two individuals that we hired right after graduation, so 18-year-old right off the graduation stage onto our shop floor, one has been already promoted into a first and entry-level fabricator. The other is considered one of our top drafters in our engineering department already. And they only have, the sky's the limit for them. We're also excited the fact that once they hit their 1 year of service with us, we'll be able to supplement tuition reimbursement for them. So it really is a win-win for everyone that comes in from these programs. We as a business, we do get funding, but we're more excited by the fact that these are individuals that may have been underemployed, maybe not have the skill set right away, but now they do have that skill set to be successful in the manufacturing world. We're also finding it a win for our current employees, those that maybe don't have a desire to be a manager, but they want to mentor or train an individual. Now they're getting to sit down with that 18-year-old student, teach them the work ethic that their parents taught them, how they were successful in the workforce, and really add to their overall training also and how to work with individuals. So we're very excited to be a part of this program.
Can I also ask you a question?
I do. Thank you. Thank you very much to the panel for the presentation. So when we talk about opportunity youth that aren't employed, a large number of those young people have disabilities, including intellectual and developmental disabilities. Can you tell me how you're reaching out to those youth, and in particular, how many individuals at Insight are experiencing intellectual or developmental disabilities and served in your region?
Not sure I have all the numbers handy, but we do have several DHS clients in our programming. So we serve about 400 kids a year through the federal funding that we get in the three counties, Marion, Polk, Yamhill. I'm not sure what the total count is on that, but they are coming from those programs. And then recently we've been having conversations with our local DHS staff and team members over there about how to create more programming for those young people, because they do tend to have some more barriers and things like that. So the programming can run a little different. So we're looking at the idea of creating cohorts of young people to get that kind of skills training and soft skills training through skills-based training programs. So, for example, I mentioned construction out in Independence. That's another program we're looking at expanding into Yamhill as well. I don't know if that's helpful.
So just to follow up.
Please.
So there's a lot of folks that come from DHS. So I'm thinking more specifically of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, so Down syndrome and other kinds of programs where we're really trying to get people out of kind of that cohort model and more into competitive and integrated employment rather than skills centers or kind of sheltered kinds of shops. Is that, I guess that's what I heard. Maybe that's not what you meant.
Not necessarily. So those are newer conversations on the table now that we're just starting to have in respect to how to engage that. So we're not a long ways down that road yet, but I'm excited that we're in fact starting to have those conversations.
And do you think the local workforce boards generally see a role for themselves in engaging this population and helping to move towards Oregon's goal of, and people with disabilities have the highest unemployment rate of any group out there? Is that a goal? Is that something that people are talking about? Are businesses open to that?
Senator Gelser, thank you. I think the workforce boards will have a voice in assisting this conversation, mm-hmm. along with bringing the employers to the table. So as these models are developed and as individuals are demonstrating the skills and we see that there's an opportunity, that we will be able to bring the employers to the table and have these conversations around, you know, if there are any barriers to hiring individuals, what are they perceiving those barriers to be, and mm-hmm. how can we address what those are so that we can get people into the workforce? I think we'll be part of that conversation.
And follow up, Mr. Chair? Yes. Thank you. I think one of the things as I think about this, the challenge to integrated competitive work for all people starts with that expectation that everybody can work and that you aren't just a DHS client or you're not just in a DHS program, but that the first place that people would be looking would be a workforce board, would be looking through their school programs, kind of the same programs that non-disabled people look at. So my hope would be that all workforce boards, local workforce boards, would look at this population of youth and unemployed adults and see that same level of responsibility to them on an equal level as non-disabled clients, and perhaps even more responsible than the Department of Human Services or more segregated programs. Because as long as we think of that population as segregated in a human service system, we're thinking about that as a service that's provided rather than an empowerment where a person is doing work. And that really has to be in the workforce system instead of in the human services system.
Thank you. Other questions? Ms. Adams, I have a question for you. The program that you describe is very exciting, I think, and I'm pleased it's been so successful. And one of the exciting things is to see how, you know, a small amount of, is it state money or federal money that creates the on-the-job training incentive? Yes.
Chair Dambro, it's both funds. There's the federal on-the-job training, and then there's the Back to Work Oregon funded.
Right.
And
so that's also a Back to Work Oregon program.
Back to Work Oregon has been a program that Bulk Handling has been able to and take advantage of and work with.
Right. Well, even those two together, it's still a relatively small amount of money that leverages a lot of employment. So it's very, very, very exciting that way. One of the hopes of, I know, on-the-job training, and we kind of alluded to this before, is that, you know, the workers will get trained by the company and will have then a commitment to the company, will stay with the company. And so it really, so then it becomes a worthwhile long-term investment by the company. Do you have concerns at all about getting these people trained and then they're just going to go somewhere else?
Chair Dembro, you know, that was the initial concern by many of the managers when we first brought this to the table with them. What we've found is it cut our turnover rate by 50%, because, again, we're not only bringing in an individual that is learning a skill set, so you've got a time period where they're ramping up and they're learning, so that retains them, but we're also paying them a higher wage than they would have gotten at, let's say, a retail store, as an example. They have the opportunity to earn the higher wage, have that family, and be able to provide for them. So where we were seeing turnover after 90 days when I first walked in the door, we very rarely, if ever, see that right now. Again, we also get to retain our more skilled workforce also, because they're getting the opportunity to basically show off what they know in front of their supervisors.
Yeah, and I have to say that really, I find that very appealing, that, you know, that point, just how being able to serve as a teacher or mentor within an organization actually makes those workers feel better about coming to work each day.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you all for coming to us today. This was very helpful. Okay, colleagues, with that, I'll close this information meeting on our workforce system, both in concept and in practice. And we have nothing else ahead of us today. On Wednesday, we'll be dealing with a number of individual bills. So we'll have public hearings on, I think, 4 bills on Wednesday. And then just, you know, one again to remind you, next Monday we have an evening hearing scheduled on the sick leave issue.
So, and is that in addition to our daytime?
That's in addition to our daytime. Yeah, the plan is in the daytime we'll have invited testimony on the subject of paid sick leave, and then in the evening the public will come. Okay. All right. So, colleagues, audience, we're adjourned.